Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world, produced at WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, December 17th, 2011. This will be our last show before the major holidays coming up, as we'll be taking the day off on December 24th. Here's what we have coming up for you today. After news you need to know, WBAI News brings us updates on protests in the New York area. Then we hear audio from a recent Occupy New Hampshire General Assembly. Stephen Fowle, editor of the New Hampshire Gazette, reads us the latest fortnightly rant. Between the Lines has a few underreported news stories for us, plus an interview about the fight for clean air in the U.S. We'll also have music and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know, this week focusing on how the Iraq occupation continues. But first, these stories. From the BBC on December 13th. Canada will formally withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, the Minister of Environment said. The country would have faced crippling fines for failing to meet its targets. Rather than heading for a 6% cut from 1990 levels by 2020, which is the Kyoto Pledge, Canada was and still is set for a rise of about 16%, more like 30% if you include forestry. Greenhouse gas emissions overall in the world may continue to rise also, since two of the world's largest polluters, the U.S. and China, failed to sign the Kyoto Agreement. And from the BBC on December 13th. An American surveillance drone has been captured and filmed in Iran, where experts are apparently examining it. Iran has rejected U.S. calls for the return of its spy equipment, and state television says military experts were in the final stages of recovering data. Nick Brown from Jane's International Defense Review said, "The real bonanza is likely to be the payload of the drone. There's probably signal intelligence, electro-optical sensors, and/or radar." But most experts believe that reverse engineering the Sentinel drone is probably beyond Iran's capability. All the control algorithms would be encrypted, so it's not as easy as just reading a hard drive and replicating it. But sharing the platform with friendly states could offer Iran substantial political capital. Anything is possible, and theoretically Iran could copy quite a lot from the basic platform, but it's the control stuff and the avionics that make it usable. Any form of unmanned technology is potentially very important to Iran, Russia, and China, said Elizabeth Quintana, a senior researcher in air power at the Royal United Services Institute. I don't know the level of scientific expertise available to Iran, but if it's true that Russia and China have sent delegates, then they do have the expertise. And from antiwar.com on December 7th. The parliamentary elections in Egypt only have one purpose, seating a new interim parliament long enough to write a new constitution and then hold new elections under that constitution. Now, not so much. After the first round of votes led to landslide victories by a pair of Islamist parties, the military government is condemning the upcoming parliament as, quote, not representative of the true will of the Egyptian voters, even though they voted for them. General Mullah says that instead of allowing Parliament to write the Constitution, the military will now appoint a new council of its own to oversee the drafting of the Constitution and will limit the already mostly powerless Parliament. This may be in response to the fact that top members of the Muslim Brotherhood recently said that their primary goal in Parliament would be ending the military's dominance of society and to move Egypt to civilian rule. And then from the BBC on December 17th. Protesters in Egypt are again clashing with security forces near Parliament in Cairo, a day after eight people were killed in unrest there. The demonstrators threw stones at riot police, who had sealed off the streets around the building with barbed wire. Security forces also fired water cannons. The demonstrators are demanding an immediate handover to civilian rule. They have been staging a sit-in in the center of Cairo since mass protests last month, in which nearly 40 people were killed. The unrest prompted Egypt's governing military council to appoint a new prime minister. On Friday, the security forces stormed a protest camp to try to move the activists away. And catch you up on this from The Nation on October 26th. The Catholic Church has for many years raised objections to the patterns of globalization, concentration of wealth, and economic inequality. And now, as the Occupy Wall Street movement also raises the issue of economic inequality, the Church is stepping up with a proposal to begin to address the extreme injustice of a system that taxes working people for necessities but allows speculators to avoid even the most basic responsibilities. The Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace has endorsed a series of reforms to the global economic, financial, and monetary systems that features as its centerpiece the development of a financial transactions tax. The Council said this should be a first stage in a longer effort by the global community to steer its institutions towards achieving the common good. The U.S. and Canadian governments have expressed opposition even to an exceptionally modest 0.1% speculation tax. The linkage between Occupy Wall Street agitation and the push for a financial transaction tax is being made by several groups that were early and enthusiastic supporters of the protest movement. A petition being put forward by various unions and NGOs to members of Congress states, quote, "The deficit issue that we face today was in large part created by the world financial crisis, a crisis caused by Wall Street speculation. Now it's time to call upon Wall Street to start paying its fair share to help us out of the hole they dug. A small tax on financial market transactions has the potential to raise significant revenue and simultaneously limit reckless short-term speculation that can threaten financial stability." And from the Economic Times and Agence France-Presse on November 20th. A top U.S. lobbying firm tied to the financial industry pitched an $850,000 plan to smear the Occupy Wall Street movement and discredit sympathetic politicians, MSNBC reported. A memo written on the letterhead of the well-known Washington lobbying firm Clark, Little, Gittledig, and Cranford urged the American Bankers Association, a client, to conduct opposition research on Occupy Wall Street in order to construct, quote, "negative narratives" about the protests and its political backers. If the Democrats make the OWS movement's anti-capitalist message a centerpiece of their campaigns, quote, "this would mean more than just short-term political discomfort for Wall Street." The lobbyists also warned the ABA, quote, "the bigger concern should be that Republicans will no longer defend Wall Street companies." And one final quote from the memo, "it may be easy to dismiss OWS as a ragtag group of protesters, but they are very nimble and capable of working the media, coordinating third-party support, and engaging officeholders to do their bidding." Close quote. Sounds like some good suggestions. And from Antiwar.com on December 14th, Representative Duncan Hunter has condemned Obama for not being more open in declaring how great a military victory the conquest of Iraq was. Obama did declare the war a success, however, saying that the 9 years of occupation was, quote, "an extraordinary achievement." The Iraq he, quote-unquote, leaves behind, putting aside the State Department's private army and the massive embassy, is starkly different from the Iraq that America found in 2003. The population has dropped considerably, both from refugees fleeing and the enormous death toll, while the cities are much more segregated along religious lines than ever before. But Iraq is celebrating, however, if only because the most obvious signs of the U.S. occupation, the ground troops, are leaving. Iraqis took to the streets today celebrating the way much of the world seems to celebrate these days, by burning the American flag. The demonstrators said today was the first annual celebration of its type, aimed at commemorating those Iraqis who resisted the occupation. And from Antiwar.com on December 15th. In Defense Secretary Leon Panetta's speech in Baghdad marking the end of the war, he said the war was worth the price in blood and treasure because it set Iraq on a path to democracy. By the most conservative estimates available, America's war in Iraq killed well over 110,000 Iraqi civilians and about 4,500 American soldiers. At least 2 million Iraqi civilians have been displaced from their homes due to the war. By most accounts, Iraqis disagree that they have even received this democracy Panetta speaks of as being worth the cost. Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Saleh al-Mutlaq warned just this week that the country is becoming a dictatorship under the U.S.-supported Maliki regime. Maliki has circumvented parliament, consolidated illegitimate power in a long trend of quasi-dictatorial behavior, harshly cracked down on peaceful political activism, harassed and even attacked journalists that were critical of him, and has been accused of torturing prisoners in secret jails. And in a diplomatic cable released by WikiLeaks, U.S. Envoy Ryan Crocker noted in 2009 that Maliki's turn towards more centralized rule is, quote, "in U.S. interest." The estimated cost of veterans' health care resulting from the war in Iraq is approximately $4 trillion over the next 50 years. Which makes the war itself seem pretty cheap. And from Antiwar.com on November 27th. The end of the U.S. occupation of Iraq won't mean the end of throwing billions of dollars at the nation, with U.S. Ambassador James Jeffrey revealing that the 2012 budget will have $6.5 billion of spending in Iraq. And most of that is military spending. That sounds awfully expensive for a war that is supposed to be over before 2012 even begins, but the bulk of it will go to the massive city-sized U.S. embassy and its 16,000 personnel. And from antiwar.com on December 16th, Iraqis will continue to see the U.S. looming overhead. According to Secretary of Defense Panetta, the Iraqi government has granted the U.S. permission to continue to fly drones over Iraqi airspace, supposedly to look for PKK militants. The drones will fly out of Turkey. The PKK's operations are almost exclusively a Turkish problem, with the group launching regular attacks against military targets inside Turkey. The revelation is likely to be controversial inside Iraq, as the drones will be facilitating Turkish strikes on Iraqi territory at a time when the Iraqi government has been publicly demanding that Turkey halt such attacks. And from antiwar.com on November 23rd. Iraqi officials say that an agreement has been reached to keep 740 U.S. trainers inside Iraq after December, even after weeks of making a fuss about how no agreement could ever be reached that would keep U.S. troops in the nation. And finally, from antiwar.com on December 15th, the Obama administration is continuing to pursue an agreement with the Iraqi government that would give U.S. defense contractors remaining there beyond 2012 immunity from Iraqi law. Based on the 2008 Status of Forces Agreement, the thousands of private contractors and mercenaries remaining in Iraq will no longer have legal immunity. Providing immunity from Iraqi law to any lingering security forces is highly unpopular in Iraq, especially after the 2007 Nisour Square massacre, in which U.S. mercenaries from Blackwater murdered 17 Iraqi civilians.
Thanks to Steve Diamond for that news we need to know. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we turn our focus to the Occupy Wall Street movement. First, with a WBAI Sunday News report from November 30th. Despite the Occupy Wall Street movement's eviction on November 15th from its Liberty Plaza base camp near Wall Street, the NYC Occupy movement has been conducting dozens of actions around the city. On November 30th, around 200 people protested an aerospace and defense finance conference hosted by Credit Suisse in Lower Manhattan, and at least 15 people were arrested. Around 300 came back in the late afternoon, including WBAI's Fred Nguyen, who filed this report.
I don't want Americans to be killed. I don't want Iraqis to be killed. I don't want us to go invading foreign countries. It hurts these countries because we invade them, and it hurts our standing in the world because we seem like crazy people going into all these countries that are half a world away and invading them. It seriously hurts our credibility. The only people who win from wars are the war profiteers who make these weapons and sell them to the government, and the government buys them using our tax money. Our tax money should stay here at home. It should be used to give health care to the sick, pensions to the elderly who have worked for our society, to buy textbooks for my school, not to cause death and destruction on the other side of the world. That's wrong.
A high school student, Sam represents a growing opinion among young Americans who identify with Occupy Wall Street. After the November 15 eviction, Occupy Wall Street New York is regrouping, according to Justin, an organizer.
Some of the people occupying were residents of New York City who are obviously still around and active. A number of others who had traveled to the city or who may have been homeless or still here were able to provide housing through organizations who've offered space. So they're still in town, and the movement now is actively working to identify housing for those who will return to the city to participate as the movement grows.
But joining the movement has its risks. This young Hispanic man from Brooklyn, who wanted to remain anonymous, describes the beating he says he and several others suffered on November 17 at the hands of the NYPD.
I was demonstrating peacefully when I was arrested and brutalized by the police. My face was swollen and a tooth of mine was knocked out. There's actually footage of me being beaten by the police. I haven't looked at that footage. I hear by the person who took the film that there were 8 police officers on top of me while I was on the ground. It's a complete abuse of power, and I believe that the NYPD wanted to make a symbol out of me on that night. I hear that several people were severely brutalized by the cops.
For the WBAI Sunday News, this is Fred Nguyen.
You're listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. On December 6, 2011, around 300 people marched and rallied in the city of Newark, New Jersey, on the 56th anniversary of the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott. This event also marked day 163 of the Daily People's Campaign for Jobs, Peace, Equality, and Justice, sponsored by the People's Organization for Progress and 122 other community and advocacy groups, modeled after the Montgomery boycott. Fred Nguyen of WBAI brings us this report.
After being evicted from Liberty Plaza in Manhattan, a group of 30 from Occupy Wall Street moved into Military Park in Newark, from which they are still negotiating with the city to establish camp. Tobias and Angela came to the teach-in at Essex County College.
In Occupy Newark, we try to show that we can work with one another, and we want to not just stick with the surface of the problems, but also the core root, because we all share the blame of how this system just went out of control. And now we are trying to wake up and reclaim what was once ours.
We've been waiting for solutions, so let's work on solutions together. My ideas with your ideas can create the world that we want for tomorrow. And we are officially occupying Military Park 24 hours a day.
Reverend Reginald Jackson, chairman of the Essex County College Board of Trustees, spoke of the importance of the campaign for jobs.
I've looked at the folk and what they've done with the Occupy Wall Street crowd. They want them to go away. But I want us to send them a message tonight. We won't go until the poor are provided for, until the sick are made well, until our children get a good education, until our communities are restored, until the people are again in control of their own destiny. And we're not going anywhere until wrong gets right.
High school students are also becoming inspired by the message of Occupy Wall Street.
My name is Andres. I go to science. I like that everybody got together, positive, to make change. And I just like doing stuff like this. I want to do this with my life because, like, we really need to change the world. And we can do it if we all work together. And we show that today. And we're not done, so.
Pop chairman Larry Hamm, who organized sit-ins of thousands in the 1970s and at 17 was elected the youngest school board member in U.S. history, encouraged students to become more involved.
Just because you're a young person does not mean you do not have a voice. You have power. People organized and moving in a unified, collective way, that is the highest form of power. Several thousand students attend this college. If you could organize but a fraction, you would have as much power as any elected official in this city.
With thanks to Bill Solo and Sandra Hayworth for their contribution to this report. For the WBAI Sunday News, this is Fred Nguyen.
You're listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we move closer to home with the audio from the first Occupy New Hampshire General Assembly, which was held in Hooksett, New Hampshire on December 3, 2011. We apologize for the poor audio quality of this segment, which runs for about 8 minutes. We think it's worth it, however, to hear what folks have to say.
We set up our mock ATMs with our Bank of America ATM and our Credit Union ATM and our giant dollar bills, and we pressed the crosswalk signal at one particular giant intersection and walked across the street to get our point across. So that's one thing that we could do without an encampment, and it's one particular issue of Occupy everywhere, but also in Occupy New Hampshire. Credit Union started in New Hampshire.
I was just going to give a brief chronological history of Occupy New Hampshire. At the very beginning of October, there were some people who had met online or knew each other from previous activism, and they said, we should have an Occupy New Hampshire. And so they advertised online. They said, there's going to be a general assembly. Everybody who wants to should come. It was in Manchester, and it was very cold out that night, but we had a large huddle of people saying, should we, first of all, do we want there to be an Occupy New Hampshire? Yes, of course. And then where should it be? And perhaps not surprisingly, we chose Manchester because we were in Manchester. And then the next weekend, we had another General Assembly in Concord. And and Concord. I mean, there were at least 100 people there at one point, and they had the opportunity to express where they thought it should be, and they agreed with us that, I'm saying us in a weird way, they agreed with the original GA that Veterans Park in Manchester would be the best place with the highest visibility, partially because Manchester is the largest city in New Hampshire, partially because it has such a high working class population and homeless population. So on October 15th, we had a general assembly at noon in Veterans Park. There were 500 people there, which was pretty exciting, and that was the beginning of our physical occupation. We moved to Victory Park that evening, and there was a lot of disagreement over how to handle city officials and how to handle police. So we stayed in Victory Park Saturday, Sunday, and then Monday morning moved back to Veterans Park because people said, no, Veterans is where the most visibility is. Veterans is where we said we would be at the original General Assemblies. And so we moved back to Veterans Park, camped out there for two more nights, and then Wednesday evening at our General Assembly, it came to our attention that the police were going to come that evening. 18 people received summonses saying, you know, you're violating curfew. 19, okay. And then 5 of those people who received summonses, including myself, said, no, we're not leaving. And we were arrested. So since then, there was no physical occupation except for our general assemblies, which we've had every single day, except for on certain Sundays, a few Sundays, and when we've had other events like at the AFL-CIO meeting hall. So it's still very alive and well. We had a very successful event at the bank, the Guerrilla Theater protest, which was large success, and people had a lot of fun at it. I wasn't there. And now, currently, our main focus is the primaries. We want to be at the primaries. All the national media are going to be there, and we're going to be there too. I think I can say with confidence that the Occupy movement has a problem with the two-party system. A huge component of the status quo is the two-party system, and the primaries are a representation of that, and we don't want to let them give their speeches and get away with their agendas without also having our say. So that's our current focus. We're planning on reoccupying Veterans Park, but there are a lot of legal issues. The trial keeps getting put off, and our lawyers believe that we're going to win on First Amendment grounds, not necessarily at the first trial, but upon appeal. And I certainly hope so, because I don't really want to go to jail. there's not a lot of good I can do from jail. We've been working with Occupy Boston, and there have been back and forth between Wall Street, you know, people visiting Wall Street and coming back with information. And we're trying to network with the Occupy movement across the world. And there's a lot of interaction on Twitter, for example.
We can't be broken down into a 12-second soundbite. This isn't just like, drugs are bad, okay, and like, just move on. The economic inequality between the classes, sure, is one of the huge ones that I think everybody does agree on. But just to boil it down, that's the one thing we're going to be, it can't be done that way. I mean, maybe that's why some people are having some problems, but we're not just some post-it note movement.
We've discussed this several times in our GAs, and when we get together for specific direct actions, that's when we have to come up with our unified message. So the Move Your Money Day was our unified message for the day, and then we all sat down and talked about, okay, we are going to go, and we are going to mic check the president. And do you need a review, or should I explain what mic check is? Mic check is call and response. So it started off as the people's mic in Zuccotti Park, but it was used previously in other activism direct actions, where basically if you don't have a microphone, you need the people to amplify you so everyone can hear. So that has been used on Karl Rove, it's been used on Michelle Bachmann, where one person is the lead and everyone else echoes that one person. So one person said, "I'll be the lead," and he yelled out, "Mic check," and he got his message out, and he repeated him in short sentences.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
But that was our message. We met the night before and we said we're going to have a few seconds. We're going to have 30 to 45 seconds to come up with a unified message that we want to get across to the president. It would be great to have a unified message, only just because everyone keeps asking for one.
I think the fact that there is no one unifying message kind of speaks volumes about the current system that we have right now, is that there's so much wrong that, you know, we don't even know where to start, most of us.
It's a new way of talking with each other instead of letting the mainstream media dictate the message and dictate what the important topics are and what are the like sides in the debate and how far can you go in one direction. This is us talking to each other honestly and not letting the dialogue be dictated by people in power.
I think for me, if I had to boil it down to what our message is that, you know, 99%, it means we're all going to have something that's important to us. And we all believe that we're not being listened to. We're united in having our voices heard because 99% of us don't feel like we're having our voices heard.
I think what's really important about maintaining a presence in New Hampshire during the primaries is that we have such an opportunity in New Hampshire where all the media is going to be here and the candidates are going to be here. And what people don't realize is they don't have this opportunity in other states where the candidates, you can go to an event and you can actually physically see the candidate. I think it's such a huge opportunity to raise awareness and to the public, but also to raise awareness to the candidates that, hey, this thing is everywhere. This thing is in New Hampshire. You know, we're not going anywhere. This thing is real. We have important things to say, and our message is going to be heard.
You just heard audio from the first Occupy New Hampshire General Assembly, which was held in Hooksett, New Hampshire, on December 3rd. Sorry about the poor audio quality, but we decided the information was important enough to run it anyway. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we have a song for you. In the spirit of the holidays, this is John Lennon and Yoko Ono singing, "Happy Christmas, War is Over."
So this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and a new one just begun. And so this is Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
That was Happy Christmas, War is Over by John Lennon. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we bring you the December 2nd fortnightly rant from the New Hampshire Gazette, the nation's oldest newspaper, based in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. It's read to us by its editor, Stephen Fowle.
The Super Committee, Congress's latest gimmick for dodging its responsibilities, announced last week that it had failed to reach an agreement to slash the federal budget deficit by $1.2 trillion over the next decade. Most Republicans promptly blamed the Democrats, citing their refusal to slash spending on social programs, which did not cause the deficit. They also blamed President Obama for not being a part of the negotiations. If he had taken a more active role, they would have complained that he was meddling. Republicans were not quite unanimous in blaming the Democrats. Former Senator Alan Simpson said that anyone who would put Grover Norquist's anti-tax pledge ahead of the needs of the country had no business being in Congress. Norquist explained to TV interviewers that Simpson's anti-pledge position was attributable to his being either senile or drunk. All six of the Republicans appointed by their party leaders to the Super Committee have signed Norquist's pledge to oppose any and all efforts to raise tax rates or lower or eliminate loopholes. It's not as if the leadership can be faulted for cherry-picking, though. In the Senate, pledge signers outnumber non-signers by nearly 6-1. In the House, the ratio of signers to non-signers is nearly 40-1. Republicans began the supercommittee negotiations by saying they would permit the Democrats to raise an additional $300 billion in new revenue, but only if the he-who-must-not-be-named tax cuts of 2001 and 2003 were made permanent. It must be borne in mind that when dealing with Republicans, the meanings of words are determined not by the dictionary, but by the National Committee. Negotiating means staking out a certain aggressive position already known to be unacceptable to the other side, declaring it to be non-negotiable, then shifting that position farther towards their ultimate goal, a return to monarchy and feudalism. The ultimate failure of the supercommittee represents, to a certain extent, a victory for the Democrats. For a change, they didn't give anything away, a laudable improvement in their performance overall. And theoretically, the he-who-must-not-be-named tax cuts will end on schedule December 30, 2012. So, petty politics aside, if the aforementioned tax cuts do end in 2012, the largest single cause of our current deficit woes will have died a natural death at the end of its allotted lifespan. As for the rest of our deficit woes, if only we had gotten the job done promptly in Afghanistan and stayed the hell out of Iraq, they never would have arisen. If the Republicans can't live without these damn tax cuts, why on earth did they ever put an expiration date on them in the first place? It goes entirely against their, well, what passes for their principles. A Senate rule nearly 40 years old allows any senator to block legislation during the reconciliation process if it significantly increases the federal deficit for a period of more than 10 years. Republicans knew the he-who-must-not-be-named tax cuts would wreak havoc on the deficit, so they gave them a 10-year drop-dead date to sneak them past the Byrd Rule, named after Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, a Democrat. Italians sometimes say dolce far niente, it's sweet to do nothing. Republicans, though they will neither say it nor admit it, believe e dolce dimenticare, it is sweet to forget. As the supercommittee shuffles off stage, let us recall its larger context. Just about the time President Obama was elected, Republicans determined that raising America's debt ceiling would be tantamount to national suicide. An amazing coincidence. Then last spring, the debt ceiling actually approached. Even Republicans could see the awful consequences that would ensue if they walked their talk. They needed a face-saving way to do that which they had promised not to do. Being Republicans, that wasn't hard. Create a supercommittee. It will miraculously undo all the damage. But wait, $600 billion in defense cuts? The poor defense contractors will starve. No problem. The cuts don't kick in until January 2013. Congress has a whole year to move the goalposts again.
Thanks to Stephen Fowle, editor of the New Hampshire Gazette, the nation's oldest newspaper, based in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, for reading us that fortnightly rant from December 2nd, 2011. To find out more about the New Hampshire Gazette, including subscription information, see www.nhgazette.com. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we go to Between the Lines for a bit of news plus an interview about the fight for clean air here in the United States.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Billings of the American Lung Association, who talks about his group's fight to protect and strengthen clean air standards that could save thousands of lives. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As 2011 comes to a close, the year has seen the United States set a record for billion-dollar extreme weather disasters. Major storms, deaths, and record property damage occurred across the country, from a heat wave in Texas to a massive tropical storm that hit the Northeast, leaving millions of people without power. According to the Associated Press, the damage caused by severe storms this year has surpassed all the damage from extreme weather during the entire decade of the 1980s. Scientists attribute the extent of storm damage in 2011 to the growing impact of climate change and some bad luck. All told, 2011 witnessed over $52 billion worth of damages. In a recent speech, NOAA Administrator Jane Lubchenco called this year's extreme weather a harbinger of things to come, with more record heat waves, droughts, and big storms. California Governor Jerry Brown is promoting a 2012 ballot initiative to raise $7 billion in new taxes to address his state's chronic budget deficits. Brown's initiative, which makes an end run around the state legislature, includes a 1% tax hike on individuals making over $250,000 a year and a 2% tax hike in the income tax rate for people making over $500,000 a year. The proposal would also raise the state sales tax. If approved by California voters, the tax initiative would be a dramatic reversal of the 1978 Proposition 13 property tax cap passed in a referendum when Brown was serving his first term as governor. In New York State, Governor Andrew Cuomo won bipartisan backing for a tax reform plan to bring in nearly $2 billion a year in new government revenue. The plan, which raises tax rates for the wealthy, replaced an existing surtax on those making over $250,000 that was set to expire. ProPublica reports that many influential New York progressives were unhappy with Cuomo's tax plan, which reduced rates for taxpayers making over $300,000 from what they were paying under the state's earlier so-called millionaire's tax. Some observers say Cuomo's 11th-hour support for modest tax increases in some higher-income brackets was due to a changing political climate influenced by the Occupy Wall Street movement. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Reg Johnson.
There's good news and bad news coming out of Congress and the administration on air pollution. On the one hand, the Environmental Protection Agency is proposing new air toxic standards for industrial boilers, which, if implemented, would prevent up to 8,100 premature deaths each year. On the other hand, President Obama recently passed up a chance to implement stricter EPA standards on ground-level ozone, or smog. He based his decision on the cost to business, despite scientific research finding that the regulations would have prevented an estimated 12,000 premature deaths annually. Meanwhile, the assault on the environment is going on full force in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, which on November 30th passed Bill H.R. 1633 out of the Energy and Commerce Committee that would exempt arsenic, heavy metals, and industrial mining operations from regulations under the Clean Air Act. Exempt sources include massive open-pit mines, smelters, cement plants, and coal processing plants. By one congressional insider's count, Republicans in the House have introduced 170 anti-environment bills since they took control of that chamber after the 2010 elections. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Paul Billings, Vice President for National Policy and Advocacy at the American Lung Association, which has been in the forefront of the fight to protect and improve clean air standards. He discusses the status of industrial boiler regulations, H.R. 1633, and President Obama's decision to kill tighter smog regulations.
This is a proposal, so they have to take public comment, and then they will hopefully finalize it in the spring of next year. So it's the first step in a process, and this has been a long process for these rules. And in fact, EPA proposed some rules earlier this year that then these are a reconsideration or a replacement for those, so they got better and more information from the regulated industry to move forward with these rules. EPA is also poised to do rules to clean up power plants that are due out by December 16th, which EPA estimates will save up to 17,000 premature deaths each year. So there are a lot of big rules pending that will have big public health benefits, and the important thing is getting them across the finish line and into law.
These proposed rules don't have to go through Congress, do they?
They don't have to go through Congress, though Congress can attempt to block them. And in fact, the House of Representatives already passed a bill that would delay the cleanup of toxic air pollution like mercury and arsenic from these boilers and change the rules forever by which EPA could regulate these pollutants in the future. So the House of Representatives really is on a campaign against public health protections, common sense regulation, and has passed a number of bills that would block, delay, or eviscerate Clean Air Act authority. The good news is that the United States Senate has stood strong and said no, and said no repeatedly, and the president has threatened to veto these bills should they reach his desk.
So it seems like it's kind of a mixed bag. You know, the president says he would veto these bills if they get to his desk, but when it was really up to him to allow the smog rule to go forward, he didn't do it.
It certainly is a mixed bag, and so it's really important that EPA does move forward with these rules to clean up the boilers, which are hopefully get done by early next year, these rules to clean up power plants, which are expected to come forward, and they're under a quarter deadline to meet that December 16th date. So we're all watching and hoping, but at the same time, very powerful interests, very moneyed interests, the Edison Electric Institute and very, very large power companies are throwing everything they can at these EPA rules to try to block and delay them and try to derail them.
Paul Billings, they're not saying they're against clean air. They're saying these new rules would be prohibitively expensive to meet and would cost jobs. Isn't that their stated position?
Yeah, they take a number of tacks to oppose these public health protections. They complain about the costs, even though the benefits far outweigh the costs. They do claim that we are in economic tough times. But at the same time, I've worked on these issues for more than 20 years. Even in economic good times, when EPA has been moving forward with clean air rules, they've complained about these things as well. So I think they trot out the same arguments each time. Generally, they don't debate about the health benefits, but even in this most recent debate with the electric companies, they've argued that mercury doesn't harm kids and there aren't benefits from these rules for protecting health and saving lives. So they're even trying to argue the health benefits, which are clearly and well established. So I wouldn't say that they don't debate whether there are clean air benefits. They try every argument they can, because what they don't want to do is make the investments to modernize their facilities, to make them more efficient, more competitive, and to provide clean air to the people that live in their communities and people live hundreds of miles away from these facilities as well.
But they live there, and their children and grandchildren live there. Clean air seems like something that human beings should be able to agree on. It seems crazy to me.
I can't explain it, because the issue of the power plant, half the power plants in the country have already installed some of these modern pollution controls. So And this is not a situation where this can't be done or hasn't been done. And so it's hard to understand why folks would oppose it. It has to be a motivation for their profit motive. They don't want to make the investment. They don't want to modernize these plants. It's hard to understand because we all do breathe the air. We all do drink the water. And I've never met anybody yet that's argued the air is too clean or the water is too safe to drink.
How would you rate the Obama administration on this key issue of clean air?
Well, we are very disappointed and angry at the president's decision on ozone smog that he made in September, and we are suing the administration in court to enforce the law and follow the science to compel a safe ozone standard, a smog standard, to be set. I guess we're also watching this decision that's being made in the next 2 weeks with respect to cleaning up toxic mercury and arsenic and acid gases from power plants and to see how we can evaluate this administration. It's really important that we put public health first, follow the science and the law, and protect people and save lives. I think it's just really important for the public to understand that there is a concerted effort in the House of Representatives to roll back these public health protections, these safeguards, and that only if the public speaks out and lets Congress know that they want air that's clean and healthy to breathe, and let their officials know that they care, will we be able to stop these attacks and make sure that we move forward with protecting public health and providing clean air for all Americans.
That was Paul Billings, Vice President for National Policy and Advocacy at the American Lung Association. Find more information on the fight for clean air by visiting our website at btlonline.org.
You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we bring you Media Minutes, with news at the intersection of media and democracy.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
A hidden application that can track just about everything users do on their cell phones has been found on several models of AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile Android phones. The software, developed by a company called Carrier IQ, can track what keys are pressed, what numbers are dialed, and what websites are visited. Carrier IQ says that just because the software receives information doesn't necessarily mean that carriers use it to gather intelligence about their users. But Free Press Internet campaign director Josh Levy says that Carrier IQ's answers about its product has only led to more questions.
What Carrier IQ software does and doesn't do, and what it does and doesn't do with the software, is a little bit unclear.
Carrier IQ may not want to take responsibility for how its software is being used, but new evidence shows that someone is using it. In response to a Freedom of Information Act request, the FBI has admitted that it uses the software for law enforcement purposes, says journalist Michael Morrissey. The agency wouldn't elaborate further, saying the release of its records could interfere with pending or prospective law enforcement proceedings.
The FBI's response confirms our darkest fears about what could be happening with Carrier IQ and the wireless carriers. Most Americans use their cell phones to talk to their friends and their families and their work colleagues. They're sending emails, they're receiving and sending text messages. When these companies have access to that information and are apparently willing to comply with requests to give it to federal agencies, we then have a major breach in our privacy.
Free Press has called for an investigation by Congress and the Department of Justice. Representative Ed Markey and Senator Al Franken have written to Carrier IQ and demanded answers about its practices. Franken has also written to AT&T, HTC, Samsung, and Sprint to learn which devices contain the software, how long it's been in use, and what data is being collected. And now the Federal Trade Commission is investigating. More than 140 phones have this software, which can't be deactivated unless the operating system is replaced. Virtually no one had heard of it until a 25-year-old researcher from Connecticut named Trevor Eckhart made a video explaining what he had discovered on his phone. Carrier IQ fanned the flames of suspicion when it tried, without success, to remove Eckhart's video from YouTube. Levy says there's a bigger story here about privacy laws in America.
At a very basic level, we need to know that our right to communicate is being protected and that big companies aren't spying on us. It's as simple as that. And if these big companies are spying on us, they need to be held accountable.
A bill that would have allowed marketers and bill collectors to make countless calls to mobile phones has fizzled in Congress. Backlash from public interest groups, lawmakers, and everyday people has helped squash the bill, which would have used up precious cell phone minutes that users pay for. The bill, called the Mobile Informational Call Act of 2011, would have amended earlier legislation that protects cell phones from robocalls, pre-automated computerized phone calls. Delicia Reynolds, legislative director of the National Association of Consumer Advocates, said the bill did not protect the public interest and would have infringed on privacy. Reynolds said consumers would have automatically been opted in to receive phone calls. Their mobile telephone numbers would have been available for purchase, and they would not have been able to choose who accessed their numbers.
So if this bill were enacted, it would mean that without consumers' consent, any business entity could obtain a consumer's phone number and robocall them on their cell phone.
Reynolds also said consumers would have been up against aggressive robocall software.
These auto-dialing systems are savvy and smart predictive dialers that know when a consumer is likely to answer a phone call. It knows after a consumer has picked up, depending on the length of the pause. This is sophisticated software that dials with intense frequency, 10 calls on the second, 60 calls on the minute.
Putting another black mark on this bill was the question of who would get charged for the phone calls. Reynolds said she was concerned that consumers would have to foot the bill, as robocalls used up cell phone minutes and potentially dipped into costly overusage time on calling plans. Nearly 25% of the population uses prepaid wireless plans in which consumers are billed for every call received. Supporters of the bill, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the American Bankers Association, said the current law needs to be modernized. Yet attorneys general in all 50 states oppose the bill. Representative Lee Terry of Nebraska was co-sponsor of the bill. On Wednesday, he declared it dead, done, buried. He said the barrage of criticism the bill produced surprised him. Chalk one up for people-powered lobbying.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. We'll be taking next week off for the holidays, but we'll be back on December 31st. Meanwhile, we send you good wishes for this holiday season. And we end our show today with this song, Dreams of Harmony, by Freda Epstein and Pete Seeger.
Wherever you rest your head tonight, we are all one family. Let's hold tight and fill the world with dreams of harmony tonight.
Wherever you rest your head tonight,
we are all one family. Let's hold tight and fill the world with dreams of harmony tonight.
Good night, bon nuit. We'll soon be the sign when a snow just lies a lava on. Sweet corn and no cheese, good night, lila do. Good night, bon nuit.
Oh, yes, soon be the sign when a snow just lies a lava on.
Good night, bon nuit.
Oh, yes, we mean a sigh. Buenas noches, la la salama, buenam. Spokoina noche, gute nacht, la elato. Wherever you rest your head tonight, we are all just families. Let's hold tight and fill the world with dreams of harmony tonight. Wherever you rest your head tonight, we are all one family. Let's hold tight and fill the world with dreams of harmony tonight.
Good night.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our ending music is Avalon by Amethystium. You can live stream our show if you are not in range of the station by going to www.portsmithcommunityradio.org. Remember that WSCA is your community radio station and needs your support to remain on the air. Go to www.portsmithcommunityradio.org to join and learn more. Ongoing technical improvements for Making Waves also need your help. Go to our website to find out how, www.nhmakingwaves.org. Tune in next Saturday for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote by Suzanne Baldini, an activist quoted on the Occupy Washington, D.C. website. I believe in peace and justice for all. Our country should support education, environmental concerns, and health care for all. Debt reduction, personally and nationally, are very important. Bring the money back to peaceful solutions for ourselves and our brothers and sisters around the world.